アロハマイカプイイホオキパイカハナナウミクマコロオカイキヤカオキオキマオカナワリワリ。So welcome back to episode 16 of Chopped, Strength Through Vulnerability. And I very much doubt that that sounded anything like it should do. But following the weekend, I've just spent surfing up at the Wave in Bristol. The only way I could kick this episode off was with another Hawaiian greeting. Given Hawaii is seen as the spiritual home of surfing, and one of the biggest factors in driving my recovery has been the urge to get back riding a surfboard. So this episode is in part going to be on the theme of surfing. However, even as a surfer listening to someone as they regale you with enthusiastic accounts of the waves they've surfed, it can be a little bit boring. And to write 4,000 words on the waves I rode up in Bristol would be fairly one-dimensional. So as much as Saturday and Sunday surfs up at the Wave were incredible, it's taken a bit of thought as to how best I fill the next 23 minutes so that I'm not just repeating. I got to my knees and then I bottom turned onto the shoulder of the Wave. Once on the shoulder, I positioned my weight onto the left-hand rail of the board. By doing this, the board turned back toward the breaking white water. By then shifting my weight back to the right-hand rail, I straightened the board up. Joining these two 180-degree turns together is a manoeuvre known as the roundhouse cutback. A roundhouse cutback allows the surfer to get out onto the green, unbroken shoulder of the Wave, but by then turning back toward the broken white water and then turning again, the surfer positions themselves in the pocket of the Wave, where the most speed is to be found. Having successfully cut back, finding myself in the pocket, I was able to pump through the middle feathering section of the Wave and ride it through to the inside. As poetic as that sounded, if I were to describe every wave I had in Bristol, I would roughly be repeating what I've just said there a further 29 times. So I started writing this on the Tuesday just gone, and writing that out reminded me of something Johnny Garnis's dad had said to me. You might remember I spoke about Johnny Garnis in episode 14, part 2 of the Spring Classic doubleheader. He was the young lad who was the top-rated MotoGP rider in the country for his age, who came off at speed somewhere in the region of 100 miles an hour. Now, I'm awful at remembering names, and I should recall what Johnny Garnis's old man was called. But by early evening on the Saturday of the Spring Classic, I was a little overcome with the emotions of the day. I suppose the point of that meandering intro was to squeeze in what Mr. Garnis had said about the day his son came off his bike. And he said, it's like the line in the Sunscreen song by Baz Luhrmann, bad things happen on a Tuesday. Now, I know the song, but I couldn't specifically recollect the line about Tuesdays. If you're like me and you know the song but not the lyric, there's the verse. A very profound verse, as it turns out. Don't worry about the future, or worry, but know that worrying is as effective as trying to solve an algebraic equation by chewing bubblegum. The real troubles in your life are apt to be things that never crossed your worried mind, the kind that blindside you at 4 p.m. on some idle Tuesday. When he said that, it reminded me of the consultations I had around the amputation of my arm. They were always on a Tuesday, and the times of those consultations wasn't far off 4 o'clock. So for me personally, there's something in that. Anyway, as I often seem to do, I've digressed ever so slightly there. I think it's 11 months since the consultation I had on a Tuesday around 4 p.m. with Captain Surgeon Professor Rory Rickard, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Taylor, and Mr. Adrian Marchbank. I don't know why I always refer to them by their full titles, as everyone who works with Professor Rickard refers to him simply as Prof. But given I'm not a colleague of his, it's never been something that I've felt I should do. As I say, I'm not exactly sure why I do that. Perhaps it's something to do with the severity of the situation I found myself in. And also, perhaps it's out of respect. You don't get the title Captain Surgeon Professor out of a Christmas cracker. It's something that's been strived for and earned. Added to that, I wouldn't have wanted the surgeon who performed the extended full four-quarter amputation to have gained his title from merely opening a Christmas cracker. Last week's episode was on the theme of anniversaries, and given this time last year it was being confirmed to me that I would be losing my arm, I suppose this episode is also going to have a retrospective feel to it. When the far-right possibility was first announced, the first words out of my mouth were, "Nah, you can't take my arm off, I'm a surfer." They were genuinely the first words I said. It's hard to explain what's going through your head when you get told you're going to have your arm amputated. But a large part of my brain's bandwidth was taken up by thoughts of surfing, or not surfing as it was going to be. I remember proposing to the three assembled highly skilled surgeons ways to avoid the amputation of my arm, suggesting take as much of the tumour out as you can, but that leaves me with my arm, and then I'll take my chances with radio and chemo to finish off what remains. It was Lieutenant Colonel Taylor who simply said, "It doesn't work like that." And this had already been explained to me by Professor Rickard. Good surgical practice for the extraction of a sarcoma requires the tumour to be encased within a minimum of 10 millimetres of healthy flesh. The tumour must remain encapsulated within the healthy flesh. Doing what I suggested would release the tumour cells around my body, freeing it to circulate around me, which would have culminated in me being absolutely riddled with cancer. Again, it was Lieutenant Colonel Taylor who simply stated, "If left, this will kill you." At the time when my wife asked, "When will you be looking to do the surgery?" I think we were both shocked when they said August the 4th. Back then, being given just over 3 weeks to find a way of averting the surgery they were suggesting, finding a second opinion that would, through the miracle of modern medical science, remove the tumour whilst at the same time retaining my arm, 3 weeks didn't seem sufficient time. But also, paradoxically, in that time, I had to get my head around the fact it was highly likely we wouldn't find an escape route from the amputation of my arm, and that I needed to find acceptance with the life-altering surgery that awaited me in less than a month's time. It wasn't long into that consultation when it had been confirmed that the course of treatment would be the extended full four-quarter amputation that I asked if we could get a second opinion. And to a man, the three surgeons all supported getting a second opinion. They all said they would do exactly the same in my situation and asked if there was a hospital we had in mind for the offering of that second opinion. Given my first encounter with cancer had been dealt with by the Christie in Manchester, and added to that, the Christie is revered as a specialist cancer treatment centre, both my wife and I requested a second opinion from the Christie. Funny thing is about second opinions, and one that you wouldn't know unless you've requested one, is all the information is sent in the post. All of it. The super high-tech scans, all of it. All the info that the hospital who've been diagnosing you have is sent in the post. You'd think it would be sent electronically, but it's not. So it might take a day or two to get up there, and then once it's there, you join the back of the queue. It's not like all the specialists working up in Manchester drop everything they're doing to review one case. I can't recall the acronym that's used to describe the multidisciplinary teams who gather weekly to discuss the cases, but there is a name for it. It just escapes me. The multidisciplinary team consists, to the best of my knowledge, of the surgeons, an oncologist, perhaps a radiologist, and possibly Macmillan nurses, all experts in their field. That team meets to discuss and review cases once a week. They've already got patients attending their hospital, and I guess second opinions for patients from other hospitals perhaps aren't high on their priority list, which I get, as they've got their own patients to diagnose and treat. In the days immediately after having it confirmed that my arm was going to be amputated, there began the desperate search to find another way out of the predicament I found myself in. A few people, my mum included, were sending messages around alternative treatments. I had a few messages from people suggesting proton beam therapy. For those like me at the time who've never heard of it, proton beam therapy enables a dose of high energy protons to be precisely targeted at a tumour, reducing the damage to surrounding healthy tissues and vital organs, which is an advantage in certain groups of patients or where the cancer is close to a critical part of the body, such as the spinal cord. Reading that, you think, okay, that sounds like it could work for me. The next search you do, where can you get proton beam therapy in the UK? To which Google responds, currently, there is one centre at the Christie NHS Foundation Trust in Manchester offering high energy proton beam treatment for anyone needing it in the UK. So you start thinking, right, get on it, yeah. I can get that at the Christie. I'm getting a second opinion at the Christie, perhaps. Just perhaps there is a way out of this for me which sees me keeping my arm. Then maybe a week or 10 days after the amputation, confirmation, consultation, my wife sent me a link to a Guardian article reviewing a Channel 4 documentary series, The Super Surgeons. The opening line of the article reads, "This awe-inspiring documentary follows the doctors at the Royal Marsden Hospital who are pushing the limits of what is medically possible." The article touches on the stories of three different cancer patients who've all been treated at the Royal Marsden. Midway through the article is Dimitrios's story. The thing on 32-year-old photographer and filmmaker Dimitrios's hand was found to be a rare and aggressive, you know what's coming next, don't you, type of sarcoma. The usual treatment would be the amputation of the arm, possibly including the shoulder. Sounds familiar. He would be unlikely to be able to continue in his work thereafter. Yeah. Dimitrios's consultant surgeon, Andy Hayes, is going to detach his circulation instead of his flesh, blast the arm with enough chemotherapy drugs to kill him if it got into the rest of his body. The vessels involved are tiny and delicate, and any mistake is potentially catastrophic, and then reattach everything when it's safe to do so. I can't recall the messages my wife sent with the article, but I remember phoning her and saying something along the lines of this, why can't they do this for me? I said it in last week's episode, how amazing Olivia, the Macmillan nurse, was. Shortly after reading that article, I emailed Olivia, attaching the article and asking if she could arrange for a third opinion from the Royal Marsden. As was always the case with any request put to Olivia, she replied within about half an hour saying she would do what she could do. With the limited time we had before the operation, time was of the essence. Before we could get a third opinion from the Marsden, it would be necessary to get the second opinion back from the Christie. Then, when the Christie have returned my notes to Derryford, they can then post them out to the Royal Marsden. In the week in the run-up to surgery, we had a further consultation with the three surgeons of the apocalypse. I can't recall which of the surgeons said if we wanted a further opinion from the Royal Marsden, then the surgery would need to be postponed, as my notes had only just been returned to Derryford. The Christie agreed with the course of treatment Derryford were proposing, but weren't entirely sure what subtype of sarcoma it was. Derryford thought it to be a myxofibrosarcoma, but I'm not sure what the Christie thought it was. It didn't really matter. At some point in the final week leading up to the surgery, I don't know where it came from, but I found acceptance with what was happening. There wasn't to be any modern day miracle of science that was going to save my arm. I started this off by saying how both my wife and I were initially shocked by how quickly they wanted to operate. Living under the constant pressure that comes with being told you've got a mango-sized tumour that goes from your clavicle down to your third rib that's unresponsive to either radio or chemotherapy and that's getting closer to your lungs. And the only way of removing it is to effectively chop a third of your upper torso off, is, believe me, very, very fucking heavy. In the end, I was glad I only had to endure that pressure for just under a month. Had they scheduled the surgery for in 3 months' time, I think my brain would have imploded. From the moment I found that lump, through all the diagnostic stages, there was an increasingly dark, increasingly threatening black cloud hanging not only over me, but also my family and my friends. The only way that cloud was blowing over was doing what had to be done. So I'm about two-thirds of the way through this episode, which I thought was going to be a big celebratory episode, sharing the joy of the surfs I had up at the wave. But as I said at the start, talking you through every wave I got would be a little bit repetitive. Yeah, man, I got to my knees, and then I bottom turned onto the shoulder of the wave. Once on the shoulder, man, I positioned my weight onto the left-hand rail of the board. By doing this, dude, the board turned back towards the breaking water. Man, I was psyching out of my mind. I suppose this episode is more of a follow-on from last week's and the theme of anniversaries. When the far-right possibility was first suggested that I may lose my arm, immediately after stating that they couldn't take my arm because I'm a surfer, my mind jumped straight to Bethany Hamilton. Now, I'm sure I've mentioned Bethany Hamilton in previous episodes, but a quick reminder, Bethany lost her arm as a teenager following a shark attack. She showed what upper limb amputees can achieve on a surfboard. She's an unbelievable surfer and surfs some of the world's biggest and most dangerous waves with one arm. My mindset has always been that I'm going to surf again, but saying that you're going to surf again and actually doing it following the amputation of your arm are two very, very different things. It's easy to say what you're going to do, but actually doing it, as I'm learning, isn't that easy. So over the past few months, there's been plenty of occasions where I've secretly questioned and doubted whether I'll be able to surf again, whether I'll get the same enjoyment from kneeboarding as I did from stand-up surfing, and whether I can actually kneeboard. There's been plenty of times over the last few months where I've had doubts around all those things. And as much as it's nice just being in the sea on a board, my goal, my dream, my ambition over the last 11 months has been to get back to the level I was at prior to August the 4th last year. Prior to heading up to Bristol, I'd had a few surfs where I can see I've progressed, but there was a good deal of apprehension about surfing up at the wave. I think I'd been there 4 or 5 times previously, and I'd always really enjoyed it and always surfed to the best of my ability. But I wanted to surf like that on my knees, so I was fairly tense on Friday evening and into Saturday morning. So here we go, here's the surf report from the wave. You ready? Okay. First session, 11 till 12, surfing the right, which means the wave breaks from right to left. First two waves I paddled for I got, but I didn't pop to my knees cleanly and came off. Now, surfing's no different from any other sport. For example, if you're a footballer at the start of the game, for the first 5 minutes of the match, all you want to do is have a few tidy touches, a few nice passes, find your feet, get your confidence. It's exactly the same in surfing. And it's always nice when you've had a couple of steady waves at the start. It just gives you a bit of added confidence. But having stacked my first two waves, I wasn't brimming with confidence. So thank fuck, I popped on my knees cleanly on the third wave and I rode it all the way onto the inside. Get the fuck in. Get in there. So with one steady wave under my belt, it gave me a bit of confidence. And my fourth and fifth wave were the same. And I can't tell you how good it felt. They were the longest rides I'd had surfing a green wave. And I came off a few more in the first session and I really ran out of juice towards the end. And it didn't help that I was wearing a 4-3 wetsuit, which is really a winter suit. So I was absolutely roasting after half an hour. Getting out of the water, I felt like I'd done okay. Disappointed I'd stacked a few and slightly concerned whether I'd have sufficient energy and strength in my legs to propel me using my flippers for the next surf. But thankfully our second surf wasn't until 5 p.m. so there was plenty of time to recharge the batteries. To those unfamiliar with the wave, it's an inland surf sport, it's a wave pool. And the wave has the distinction of being the first commercial wave garden in Europe, with a surfing lagoon spanning 150 metres in length. It has waves suitable for everyone and delivers an unrivalled inland surfing experience. And when you first arrive, you're struck by what an incredible feat of engineering it is. How they just turn the waves on, and you can see these waves just breaking. And sessions run for around an hour, and in that hour there's 10 sets, and every set has about 20 waves. So entering the water for our 5 p.m. surf, the business overlord had kindly lent me a shorty wetsuit, so I wasn't going to cook in my 4-3. And paddling out, my legs felt okay, and I feel like I'm starting to improve my kicking technique with the flippers on. Paddled for my first wave, and it was the business overlord who said to me after our first surf, "There's a lot going on for you when you're paddling. Your legs are kicking, you're paddling with one arm, and then you're grabbing the handle with your arm when you pop to your knees. That's a lot going on." Which, until he pointed it out, I hadn't really given much thought to, but yeah, there is a lot going on in catching a wave. My first wave was a beauty. I popped to my knees cleanly, nice cut back, flew through the feathering section and rolled it all the way onto the inside. Honestly, what a feeling. I cannot tell you how good that felt. And that's how my second surf went. I made all but two of the waves I went for. And the beauty of surfing at the wave, every wave is pretty much the same. So you're really able to hone and perfect your technique. Following that surf, for the first time, many of my fears were allayed. I am able to kneeboard, even with one arm. And kneeboarding is really enjoyable. Possibly because you're closer to the wave, and I think there's similar levels of fun to be had kneeboarding as there is with stand-up surfing. So, yeah, amazing. During that second surf, I've been chatting to an older Welsh guy who was there for his birthday. And after the surf, we were having a chat, and he was full of praise. He was amazed that it had been just 11 months since the amputation of my arm. And his daughter came over, she's probably early 30s, and it's incredible to hear people's reactions. It's really humbling. And she told me that she thought I was unbelievable. Absolutely amazing, I think she said. And I can't honestly tell you how amazing that surf felt. It felt like that surf washed away so many of the anxieties I've carried around for the last 12 months. All the fears of never surfing again have been washed away by the sheer, unadulterated joy of riding a board on water. So arriving on the Sunday morning, some apprehension had returned. Would I be able to replicate the last surf I'd had? Or would it be a case of after the Lord Mayor's show? But it wasn't. If anything, with the confidence gleaned from the previous day's second surf, I rode it even better. Rather than just racing through the middle section, I began to throw in a bit more bottom-to-top surfing, so bottom turns into top turns, which generates more speed. And the great thing about kneeboarding is you're a lot closer to the water, which enables you to get your hand in the wave, which feels amazing. And it also allows you to stall the board, keeping you in the pocket. I've said this many times, I can't tell you how amazing that feels. With the session over, I had a quick shower, and then by chance I got chatting to one of the coaches there, and he was full of praise, saying you were getting some really nice ones out there. Turns out he's one of the coaches for the GB para surf team. And he asked me if I was interested in getting involved in parasurfing. And I told him that I am keen, but International Surfing Association, ISA rules, prevent me from entering into kneeboarding contests. But he was a nice guy and we had a good chat, and hopefully catch up with him again and something can come out of it. I'd wrote the following in my initial business plan. Through my social media accounts, I am documenting my journey following the amputation of my left arm. Physically, my aim is to compete at the Adaptive Surf Open in Bristol, wearing branded, bespoke, tailored chop garments. Working toward and promoting that goal is providing a physical and mental focus during my recovery and has been incredibly beneficial for my mental well-being following a time of trauma. This is the inspiration behind CHOT. When I wrote that, I thought the Adaptive Surfing Open was going to be at the Wave, as it was the previous year. At the end of July. That was my goal, to surf the wave wearing my own branded Adaptive CHOT clothing. This year's Adaptive Surfing Open is up in Croyde in September, And given I'm an upper limb amputee knee boarder, it doesn't look like I'll be able to enter. But had the event been on at the Wave and I were allowed to enter into the knee board category, I would have achieved the goal I set myself at the start of the year. I did it. And I'd like to thank everybody who's helped and supported me over the last 12 months. Without your help, without your support, without people having my back the way they have, I don't think any of this would have been possible, so thank you. And with that, I'm going to bring this episode to a close, but a bit of housekeeping before I do. First up, thanks to everyone who's listened and taken Chopped Strength Through Vulnerability to 1,000 downloads. Nice one, thank you. And if you can subscribe to this pod from wherever you get your podcast, it helps out. Thanks to those who've already subscribed and to those who share the pod, that really helps spread the word. So again, thank you very much. There'll be no pod next week as I'm going into my wife's daughter's school talking to the 4 Year 5 classes about difference. So once this episode is recorded and published, I'll be getting to work writing out a 30-minute discussion around the theme of difference suitable for 9 and 10-year-olds. And finally, here's the second of the two poems I wrote back in 2008. Are you ready for this? Are you ready? The elephant in the castle. What am I doing here? Shrieked the elephant in the castle. Calm down, relax, look around, said both the hare and the hound. Quit with the furore and hassle. Now look here, dear hound, the hare did declare. I'll bet you a pound yon funt can't touch the ground without making a sound. It was a bet, it was a wager, in a pub called the Major. Heeding their warning, the elephant lay down yawning, inadvertently crushing the daughter of the oh-so-famous Queen Victoria, without even so much as a warning. At the sight of the mess that flew from her dress, there was considerable distress from the frog in the bucket, who faced the full force and just took it. The frog jumped from the bucket and shouted, "Oh, well, fuck it, why did I not try to duck it?" The exclamation served as confirmation of the hare's assertion that the elephant could not sit down without making a sound. As always, thank you for giving your precious, precious time to listen to me waffle on. Thank you. Go steady. I'm out.